Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
There should be no expectation on behalf of the premiers and the chief ministers that when we reach those targets of 70 and 80%, the scale of our economic support will continue in the way that it has.
Welcome, lovely people of podcast, to the show. You are with Catherine Murphy, the host and political editor of Guardian Australia, and with me is Scott Morrison's roommate.
Well, who could that be? Good afternoon. Nice to be with you, Catherine.
Well, why don't you introduce yourself?
My name is Josh Frydenberg. I've been a house guest in the Parliament for just over 10 years now and represent the electorate of Kooyong. Feel very privileged to be the deputy leader of the Liberal Party, should I say it, on a Guardian podcast.
It's all right. Nothing explodes. It's fine.
And the Treasurer of Australia, which is challenging at the best of times, not least of which during a pandemic.
Right at the moment. We're not going to linger long on your house visit at the Lodge, but it's so deeply weird, I have to ask you a couple of questions about it.
I see that you and Nikki Sabre both think that.
No, it's like it is. I'm sorry. Look, we should tell the listeners, actually, because the context is relevant, that in Canberra, in the fly-in, fly-out culture, there is a culture of share houses in Canberra amongst parliamentarians. So it's not quite as weird as it would appear to the rest of the universe. But nonetheless, it is deeply weird that you are bunking in with the Prime Minister. So my questions are, is he surveilling you or are you surveilling him?
Well, I accepted his generous invitation and, you know, it was a pretty special opportunity because... it's not only a good opportunity to work and talk with him about a lot of the issues that we're dealing with, but it was also it's got amazing history, the Lodge, and it's a special place, and the bed's no bigger than I wouldn't have in my normal abode, but the meal sizes are a little bit bigger. But other than that, I spend most of my time actually in and out of Parliament House still, but because of the fact that the ACT is in lockdown, you're not going out as you normally would. You're not associating with colleagues as you normally would. And so I suppose when he's in a big house like that by himself, he was happy to have company. And, you know, we watch a bit of TV, eat dinner together, play a bit of pool. But largely we spend most of our time actually in the office.
But he invited you. Sorry, we aren't going to stay here forever, even though it sounds like we are. We aren't. So he invited you, and you don't think that's weird at all?
No, I don't. You know, pandemics are weird, if you ask me, because certainly this one doesn't come around very often. And he's in the house by himself, like me. We're away from our family and our children, and our wives, and so this is, you know, a good opportunity to at least have some friendship in what is can normally be quite a lonely place.
Okay, I'll cease further judgments.
Pass or fail.
Well, I still think it's really deeply weird, but let's move on to portfolio areas and areas where you've sort of picked up arguments and run with them, I suppose, over the last couple of weeks in particular. Mm. You've become, because you've actually been there the whole time, really, but you're becoming more forthright as the living with COVID evangelist of the government. I'll put it that way. Why?
Well, evangelical is not necessarily a term that
you would acquaint
with me. But the reality is, we're in a very different place as a country this year compared to last year. Last year there was no vaccine. This year there is. The number of people who are receiving the vaccine is growing by the day, more than 300,000 by the day. And based on a, you know, world-leading report and a set of modelling by the Doherty Institute, we've now got targets of 70 and 80% where we can shoot for and reach and therefore ease restrictions after that. And my view is that we have to learn to live with COVID because no country has been able to eliminate it. And based on the best medical advice to us right now, we're not about to eliminate it. So it's a question of adjusting to its reality. And that means getting as many people vaccinated as soon as possible, having a set of restrictions that are still in place, but they're not as stringent as the lockdowns we're seeing now in New South Wales, Victoria and the ACT. And by doing so, we can resume our life in a COVID-safe way. Yeah. And that means kids going back to school and businesses reopening.
Do you think, though, obviously a number of parliamentarians are reporting frustration building up in the two lockdown states in New South Wales and Victoria, right? Yeah. Do you think people...
Frustration, weariness, fatigue, all of that.
Yeah, all of that, right? But do you think people in Queensland and WA and Tasmania and South Australia want to live with COVID?
I do, in the sense that they understand that reality that you can't eliminate it. But whether they want to move to that place as fast as those in New South Wales and Victoria is a different question. And I suspect New South Wales will get there first. Victoria will look very closely at the New South Wales experience and the ability of their health system to cope with those increased cases and the easing of restrictions. Then I think they follow, and South Australia and then other states follow after that. I think Western Australia will be a hard nut to crack in respect of getting them to ease the restrictions, particularly the border closures. But again, it's an inevitability in my mind. And to think that every business in WA is doing well at the moment is wrong. We just announced a package of support for tourism businesses in partnership with the McGowan government in Western Australia because a lot of those businesses are really hurting because of the border closures. So I don't think the economy can sustain the level of economic support we're providing right now indefinitely, certainly not well beyond when we get to those 70 and 80% targets. And to be honest, Catherine, I actually think the well-being of Australians is so important here, to state the obvious. But the health outcome of preventing COVID is not the only one that should be front of mind. We've got to be thinking about the mental health impacts of the lockdowns. And yes, I'm a product of the Victorian experience in some respects, or my perspective is. And the fact that they've had more than 200 days of lockdown, the fact that kids have not been in the classroom is really, really significant. And, you know, I've got a GP in my own electorate who talks about the fact that giving kids as young as 12 antidepressants because they're really struggling. And you and I have talked about this.
Yeah,
and so I think it's about getting the balance right.
No. And I completely acknowledge that lockdowns are not a cost-free strategy, either in dollars or in mental health terms. But the problem the government's got, isn't it, is you've spent effectively 18 months with the mantra being lives and livelihoods, right? Yes. That has been a bulletproof political mantra for you guys. That has been a statement of your priorities. Now you're trying to pick the country up and put it down in a different place, a place where there is a higher level of comfort with hospitalisations, with illness, with death. We've not geared ourselves for that in Australia. In the US, they certainly have. In the UK, they have. This is. Do you acknowledge that this is very politically risky for the government at this point?
Well, I acknowledge that it's a new conversation and that some people will be uncomfortable with that, but also many will understand that is the reality with which we confront. And when you hear the Doherty Institute say zero COVID forever is unrealistic, You know, it's not just the politicians who are saying learn to live with COVID. It's actually the medical experts. And people turn on their TVs and they see, you know, full houses at the sporting stadiums in the US or the UK, and they say, well, yes, they've got a high vaccination rate, but when are we going to join that rite of passage, if you like? And so it is a conversation we have to have, and that's why I've been at least very upfront. There's going to be deaths, tragic as they are. There's going to be more people with severe illness and there will be more cases, but there is no alternative but to open up when it is safe to do so, and that's where the Doherty work, I think, comes into play.
Yeah, and you have been commendably honest. You are calling it as it is. What is your personal level of comfort of with deaths? How many deaths would you be comfortable with?
Well, again, it's based on what the Doherty Institute says it happens at 70 and 80%. And they distinguish between sort of optimal health orders or minimal health orders, and the rate of death comes down substantially as a result of having optimal health orders. Now, they're optimal health orders short of lockdowns. There's mask wearing and there's social distancing and
different
hygiene
packages,
practices and all of those sort of things.
Yeah, but you're avoiding the question. You give me a number. Is it the amount of people who die of the flu every year? Is it more than that? Is it less than that? Like what? It's fine. You see what my point is? It's fine to say we've got to be more comfortable with deaths and hospitalisations, but it's kind of an abstract concept unless you're prepared to put a number on it. So what's the number?
Well, again, influenza is instructive because that is what, again, Doherty referenced, and they said Australia has 200,000 cases of influenza each year and 600 deaths, and they've pointed out how we've learned to live with that. Now, in their report that came out in late August, 23rd of August, they said very clearly that at 70% vaccination coverage, they could see, with optimal public health measures and no lockdowns, that infections could be reduced to just under 3,000, and they referenced 13 deaths. Now, that number may or may not end up being accurate. Modelling
well,
really
it reflects it. Well, it reflects the inputs.
But exactly, it reflects the inputs. But they did say, because this has obviously been a topic of great discussion, what happens when you've got hundreds, if not thousands, of cases and you start easing restrictions. And they've made the very valid point that whether you start with 30 cases or 800 cases, it's still safe to open at those numbers of vaccinations.
They do say, though, at the 70% threshold, they said it in their first report, and I gather they've said it in the recut version, that caution is required at 70%. Now, you said very recently...
Caution is always important.
Obviously, but you said recently that state and territory leaders should not just assume that the money tree down there in the courtyard that has funded JobKeeper and JobSeeker and all this other truckloads.
It's been growing profusely.
Well, indeed. It's a
branches
big,
have been coming off every single
it
day.
It is a big money tree. You've said basically the money tree is, you shouldn't assume the money tree is there at 70%. Now, hang on a minute. That doesn't really align with what Doherty's saying. Doherty's saying at 70% you've got to be cautious. You've got to be quite cautious. Lockdowns are part of the mix. Lockdowns may persist at 70%. So are you serious?
Well, firstly, what Doherty actually said was that at 70% and 80%, that stringent lockdowns are unlikely. That were their words. They didn't say you would eradicate it, lockdowns, but they said they were unlikely. What I was and have been consistently saying and say again today is there should be no expectation on behalf of the premiers and the chief ministers that when we reach those targets of 70% and 80%, the scale of our economic support will continue in the way that it has. And as you know, we've pivoted in our economic support from the JobKeeper programs and the cash flow boosts and the 750
to payments, whatever the new payments
to now a COVID disaster payment, which is based on hours of work that have been lost, but also the economic support for small business, which we've done on a 50-50 basis with all the states and territories. when we get to those 70 and 80%, we're really going to be looking to the states and the territories to fulfil that agreement that they reached at National Cabinet.
Look, going to the Treasury work, which yes. actually hasn't had as much publicity as yes. the Doherty work, but it's actually really interesting. I read it for the first time this week properly. Yes. Now, Treasury says, that the lowest cost, response to the pandemic is maintaining a public health response, first point. The other thing that's really interesting to me is in their analysis, they did not run a scenario about Australia's health system having a significant breach in an outbreak. Now, that seems to me to be an entirely realistic scenario. If you look at what's playing out in Sydney at the moment, we've got ambulances ramping, not able to get into hospitals. Mm. This isn't hysteria, mm. right? This is an actual present risk mm. associated with the transition that you're currently working on. Mm. Treasury didn't look at that, but they said the cost of that would be extremely significant mm. in the event that that happened. So do you accept that this is a balance? That you can't just wave your wand, remove all the restrictions because, getting back to your portfolio interest, which is different, obviously, to your mm-hmm. interest as a human being, a Victorian, yeah. a father, yeah. a friend, yeah. all yeah. of that, that yeah. this is a really finely balanced set of decisions.
I agree. And you have to be flexible to adapt to new sets of circumstances when they arise. What was interesting about the Treasury analysis was that even when you get to those 70 and 80% targets, you are still going to require some restrictions
yeah.
and they're still going to cost the economy.
Yeah.
So at 70%, Treasury say $200 million a week. Right now, we're seeing $2 billion a week being lost in terms of economic activity as a result of the lockdowns in our biggest two states. So the cost does come down, but it's not. It doesn't come down to zero, and it is about getting the balance right. And there is no rule book. You and I don't know if there's going to be a new variant of the strain as we turn into a new year after Christmas.
No, or even sooner. Not. I mean, I don't want to depress everybody, and it's.
And we shouldn't because. No. And I think that's a really important point. The reason why this plan is so important and sticking to it is so important is because we have to give people hope. And people are getting the jab, yes, to protect themselves and to protect their families, but they're also expecting something in return, and that is their lives back in a COVID-safe way. And it's no coincidence that the fastest increase in vaccinations are in the lockdown states. In New South Wales and Victoria, because these people are living it and breathing it and they want to get out of it. And if you are sitting in Queensland and Western Australia and think that you can live COVID-free or without lockdowns for the next 6 months, you're wrong because it could very easily get over a border and come into your state. So the only long-term solution is to get vaccinated and then to have the optimal restrictions in place to live with COVID safely.
Tell me what you've learned.
Yep.
During this pandemic because, I know, yeah. and you and I do speak regularly, yeah. What's the biggest thing you've learned?
Well, I've learned lots of things. The first is you do have to move quickly in a pandemic. Where we did that early on, for example, closing the international borders, we got a good dividend for the country through doing that. As well as that, on the economic side of our response, for example, when we brought in JobKeeper, the immediate improvement in consumer confidence and business confidence was obvious. But I suppose the biggest thing, if you want me to single out one, it's that you need to be able to adapt to changing circumstances because things change very quickly, and if your policies are set and forget, you quickly get swamped. Now, in order to adapt, you have to have the right internal processes, and we have been meeting, every day, NSCs, ERCs, cabinet meetings, with my own department, and the public service have been brilliant and professional, and, as you would expect, nonpartisan. And so being able to rely on those experts, whether they're health or economic experts, has been a really important part of the national response. And we have been taking the advice, and I think that advice has served the country well.
And it's sort of interesting to me, there's always been this sort of strange balancing act, which is sort of more the Prime Minister's than yours, but, you know, given your roommates. Sorry, had to. But no, this idea that there's been some tension in the government, largely sotto voce, but about the Prime Minister being the Prime Minister of the Premiers or the Prime Minister of his own cabinet, his own party room, all of that sort of stuff. Like, have you learned more about balancing those imperatives as you've gone along?
Well, the Premiers and the Chief Ministers have been elevated in this crisis.
Well, they're the ones with the power.
Constitutionally, they've got the power around public health orders, and it's become sort of, you know, compulsory viewing for many Victorians or people in New South Wales to turn on and find the latest new information from their premiers. And that is different to, I think, how politics has operated in the past. I think pre-pandemic, you would have struggled to get someone in Queensland who could name the Premier in, you know, WA or Victoria and vice versa.
Yeah.
But they have become household names. The other thing is, I think prior to this pandemic, people, certainly the feedback I've had, is people have expected in their lives that the big decisions affecting them have been made by the federal government, even though we know state governments are critical in everything from health and education to law and order and particularly service delivery.
Yeah.
But that has been turned on its head in this crisis. And suddenly state premiers and chief ministers and, should I dare say it, chief medical officers have had this incredible
presence
and power. And it's been very frustrating for a lot of people. Certainly the ones who have contacted me said, well, why can't you fix this? Why can't you get a nationally consistent approach?
Yeah,
why can't
a lot you of MPs are reporting this.
Yeah, why can't you just override the state orders?
Yeah, why don't you get the premiers in hand?
Yeah, and it doesn't work like that. And I think that has been frustrating for a lot of people, particularly exacerbated by those who have been subject to lockdowns and, you know, living with their freedoms curtailed. Do I think that becomes a permanent feature of our political system? No. I do think we can get back to where we were post-pandemic. Although there's now a broader question, which is how long will this pandemic be with us? And neither you or I can answer that definitively. I suspect it's going to be around for some time and it's probably not the last pandemic either.
No.
And so when I think about the world post-COVID, living with COVID, it is with health and medical challenges and the medical advice and all of that being, you know, front and centre to a lot of decision-making in the future.
Tell me, in terms of learning, would you, if you had your time over, structure JobKeeper differently? Because the impression people in the community have got now is that a whole lot of companies who didn't need cash basically got a massive flotation through their balance sheets as a consequence of that program. You haven't clawed it back. They've been allowed to trouser it. Would you do it differently if you had your time over?
Well, I'm really glad you've asked me that question because it gives me an opportunity to explain to the listeners why we did what we did with JobKeeper and what I think about the program. Go back to when we introduced it and there were tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people lining up outside Centrelink, and people were not only fearful of losing their job but fearful of losing their homes. And everyone was saying it was reminiscent of the Great Depression. We then responded with JobKeeper, which is not, you know, the default position of a Liberal Party treasurer.
Certainly not.
An economy-wide, nationwide wage subsidy at a flat rate of $1,500. It had the immediate effect of putting a safety net under the economy, keeping people formally connected to their employer and saying to businesses, we have your back. And we initially did it for 6 months only. But when we talked earlier about being flexible and able to to readjust. Learn. Well, we extended it for another 6 months.
Yeah.
Now, we based it on an anticipated decline in turnover for the first 6 months. The second 6 months were based on an actual decline in turnover. The reason why we did that at the time, based on advice, was that if we had tried to configure the scheme based on a proportion of someone's income or indeed of an actual decline, it could have taken months to get the money out the door. And it would have then delayed what was a vitally important program.
No, I totally accept all that.
That's why we did the anticipated decline.
Yeah.
Now, Treasury's analysis of what happened, for example, in April, is that the average decline was 37% when you had to have an anticipated decline of 30%. So I have no doubt that businesses who needed JobKeeper, bearing in mind 98% were small and medium-sized businesses, received it. But have some businesses got through this crisis very strongly? Have they paid dividends? Have they paid bonuses? Yes. Should they pay back JobKeeper? Absolutely. If they're in the if they've got the ability to pay it back, they should.
Well, why not make them?
Because we don't retrospectively change tax laws based on to claw money back from people who entered into a program in good faith based on the rules for eligibility at that time.
But you claw back, you know, debt from welfare recipients. Yeah,
I really do feel like that's a false analogy, because one is in accordance with the law, the other is not. Now, you can have a debate about whether that anticipated decline in turnover should have been only for 3 months, not 6 months, as we did. Mm. We can have that debate. But based on what I know, Catherine, at that time, don't forget in the June quarter, economic growth fell by 7% across the country, record amounts. We saw the unemployment rate subsequently reach 7.4%. It's now 4.6%. And, you know, Australia was looking at the edge of the economic abyss, and that's why we responded the way we did. So I am actually in the camp, as you would not be surprised, of saying I'm very proud of what JobKeeper did for the economy. And what you cannot take away from JobKeeper and the other economic supports is that they ensured a very strong economic rebound.
Yeah.
And if you ask me what has been the biggest achievement on the economic side, it's been preventing the long-term scarring of the labour market, where you would have seen a lot of people unemployed for a long time, as we saw after the 80s and 90s recession.
Yeah. We're on the clock, sadly. I'd go a bit more.
We're happy to.
No. Well, I would go a bit more on that issue, but let's. Let's because I want to take you to energy and climate in a minute, which is an area of mutual interest. Well, it's an obsession of mine and an issue of, well, more than glancing interest of yours.
Well, we were talking about scarring just before,
exactly. No, but just on the JobKeeper question, just one thing, right? So, okay, so you've explained your rationale.
Yes.
But my question was a simple one.
Yes.
If you had your time over again, would you do it the same?
I don't regret what we did at that time.
So is that no or yes?
Because firstly, you can't have 20/20 hindsight in a crisis such as this. I stand by what we did, and I think we made the right decisions. Should some businesses, if they can pay that money back, absolutely. First to say that.
Have you rung any of them and said pay it back? Have you actually done that?
I've said it very publicly.
No, but to them, like.
Well, I don't normally ring up businesses and say
demand money.
I looked at your latest profit and loss scheme. By the way, if you are a publicly listed company, you're required to disclose it.
Yeah.
And that's how we know.
Yes.
How those particular companies, how much they've received from JobKeeper, because as you would expect and appreciate, tax information is subject to the privacy laws, and only the tax office are the ones who need to know. But the program has been a great success. It was described as a remarkable program by the Reserve Bank governor, and it has been a key reason why our economy has bounced back so strongly.
Let's do energy and climate now. Do you think that global capital has made a choice?
I definitely think climate is influencing global capital markets in a significant way. We're now starting to see priced in transition risk, physical risk. It's affecting the asset allocation across the global capital markets. We're going to see more and more climate-related or disclosure. And, you know, regulatory agencies are across that, both here and overseas. Material risks to businesses. But this is something that is moving pretty rapidly. I had a conversation not that long ago with Mark Carney, who, as you know, is the former governor of the Bank of England, and he's been very engaged in this program. And it was a very interesting discussion to sort of swap notes. I talked to the central bank governor, Phil Lowe. He says that it's a major topic at central bank governors' meetings. So, yes, it is being it is influencing in a significant way global capital.
Is it, as Guy Debelle says, a risk to financial stability?
Well, I think it's a factor in financial markets. You know, Guy Debelle's well placed as the deputy governor of the Reserve Bank.
Quite a bright fellow.
And has done a very good job. So it is a factor behind financial stability, but it's again being priced in now, started to be priced in to decision making.
Do you think that the government, I mean, the Prime Minister has hinted as much, should the government take an updated 2030 target to the COP in Glasgow in November?
I'm very comfortable with the target that we've got, the 26 to 28% reduction by 2030
Can
on
you
our 2005
better?
Level.
Can you do better was
well,
the question.
Well, again, the transition is underway. You talk about transitions in capital markets. The transition is underway in the domestic energy market, and we are on track not just to meet but to actually beat that 26 to 28% target.
Not at the moment, you're not.
Well, that you can debate that.
No, I just look at the numbers, the government, the official data.
Well, I can tell you that in the last 2 years, we've taken the equivalent of 15 million cars off the road. I can tell you that we are seeing renewable energy being installed on a per capita basis faster than you see in New Zealand, faster than Japan, faster than the United States, faster than many other comparable economies. You know the numbers, Catherine. 1 in 4 households, have rooftop solar. Mm. We've got a technology investment roadmap. We're investing in everything from Snowy Hydro 2.0 to more interconnectors to bring, you know, the great renewable resource in Tasmania here to the mainland. Battery of the nation. All those things that I've been involved in. But there are also real issues about the reliability of the grid as this transition takes place. You know, probably a lot of the listeners today won't like our focus on gas, but that is a transition fuel. And you do need that baseload power in the system. And so the combination of batteries, pumped hydro, gas as a peaker, they're all important. And I did mock the fact, made light of the fact that I had a few scars from the previous portfolio. I tried to do as well as I could in that. I do think we made some gains. We did see a reliability guarantee come in place, but this issue has been, you know, perennially difficult for successive governments, and that's because I've never seen an issue in my political experience which has played to the extremes like this one, played to the extremes of the debate.
Well, it plays to the extremes because you guys weaponised it for 10 years.
Well, I don't accept that.
Well, you do really accept that, I think.
But anyway, look, the left and the right on the extremes have played this. It's become obviously not just an economic battle or an engineering battle or a scientific battle. It's also become a bit of a cultural battle. But I do think that is changing, maybe not as fast as some people would like it to be, maybe faster than others would like it to be. But it is changing, and that is why we've been doing what we're doing.
I acknowledge that. You know your constituents at home in Kooyong, who you probably haven't seen for 6 months, but anyway, yeah, you'll get home at some point.
You mean the ones who are chaining themselves to my doors?
Well, and, no.
Throwing off flares and, breaching the peace. Yeah.
I think the ones you would be more concerned about actually would be thoughtful, caring Liberal voters who think you guys have been complete bastards on climate change. But anyway, putting that to one side, what's a number of your colleagues say to me, they don't want to do another election like they did in 2019 on climate change, where basically they felt under siege from reasonable-minded people in the community who correctly understand, you know, your government's terrible record in this area. So if the question, sorry, long preachy preamble, there is a question coming. Do you want to go home to your electors, to your constituents in Kooyong without a firm commitment to net zero by 2050?
Well, I said on budget night that we want to get to net zero and preferably by 2050.
Not a commitment though, is it?
But as you know, that's what our position has been, and we continue to roll out various policy initiatives that are designed to lower the carbon footprint. Look, I take this issue very seriously. I've been very consistent as well that climate change is real and that man is contributing to it, and we need to take the relevant actions to reduce our emissions. I think technology does offer an incredible opportunity, and that's why we're investing in hydrogen as one source, cleaner source of energy. But we're doing a lot of other things as well. And you earlier in the conversation referenced balance. That also applies to the energy debate, which is when you transition an energy system, you need to be very conscious of how you ensure that it stays reliable and that energy prices remain affordable. And look, Hazelwood was a dirty old brown coal fire power station in Victoria. But when it closed, we saw a massive spike in the wholesale price, which then flowed on into other states because it was nearly a quarter of Victoria's energy supply. You can't afford to see that again because you know who pays the highest price?
Sure.
It's those disadvantaged in our community because their spend on energy or electricity as a proportion of their disposable higher income is higher than wealthier people. So that's why we set up the Energy Security Board under the very strong leadership of Kerry Schott. That is why, I work closely with IEMO. And also the AEMC and all the other regulators in this space, the ACCC on the gas market, for example, to try to bring some regulatory rigor to this process and to take the experts' advice.
And because I've been quite combative, I'll also pay you the compliment of saying that you did, to my observation, do everything you could while you held that portfolio in order to move the dial, so I will give you that gesture of respect.
Well, I tried to bring together the stakeholders.
You did,
right?
Yes.
And that included those who were active in industry who were the ultimate users of energy, as well as those who were on the research side, and those who are on the regulatory side, and those who are advocating strongly for lower emissions.
Let's end with this. For your constituents, and I imagine quite a number of them will listen to this conversation.
I hope so.
Your folks at home. Yeah. Are you going to, before the end of this year, before Glasgow, are you going to bring them good news on a... No, I'm serious. I'm not being fatuous.
I know where you're going, and that's a very legitimate question. Look, we're having lots of internal conversations. I can't say any more than that. We're having lots of internal conversations about this issue. And there are lots of angles to it. You and I have discussed the global capital finance side of it. That's one angle of it. Another is, what does it mean for our export industries?
Yes.
And therefore, jobs. Another is, what does it mean for our electricity market and the affordability and the stability of that? What does it mean for our general manufacturing approach in this country? There's lots and lots of angles to this, but there is progress and there are serious conversations across the board internally in government about this issue. Without giving that away, there's a lot of, you know, a lot of progress is being made. And look, Catherine, you've seen politics as close up
for centuries,
as long as anyone, right?
Yes.
The way you move the dial on issues like this is you try to take people with you. If you try to storm the barricades, you never win, not on this one. And the people who want you to storm the barricades often don't have certainly your best interests at heart, but don't have, I don't think, the nation's best interests at heart, because then they doom you to fail. So you've got to persuade, you've got to promote, you've got to bring an evidence-based approach. And, of course, there's always a political lens to difficult issues like this. But there is progress being made, and it's being made behind closed doors.
Okay. We'll keep you to progress being made. Josh Frydenberg, thank you for your time. I really do appreciate it. Thank you to Miles Martignoni, who's the EP of this show. And thank you to Karishma Luthia for cutting this episode. Thank you all you guys for listening. Obviously, share, review, all of the usual drill. We'll be back next week.
Thanks, Catherine, and all the best to you and your pointy pen.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win. And support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode, and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.